This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Well, welcome to a new season of Soul by Todd Richards. This is season two. I would say this is season two, but it's probably COVID four season. Just to give listeners an understanding where we are, we're in this Delta variant. We've seen a lot of things happen in our country, both positive and negative. And we're looking forward to really still discussing the impact of African-American cooking, Afro cooking, Afro cuisine, and also better understanding how we can move food forward and all give us a place at the table. And for this season, I'm really just happy to have so many more friends here. You know, last season, I had a lot of friends join me, and it was great. But this one, I'm exploring even more and really diving, you know, way deeper into the waters to understand how we got to this place, how we can be better in this place, and what's the future, not only for ourselves as chefs, restaurateurs, owners, farmers, fishermen, cattle ranchers, but how can we make this world a better place? I'm really proud to have on season two, first episode, my great friend, Kevin Mitchell. And Kevin and I go way back. Like I always say, anybody knows me, I like to drink a lot of whiskey. So we go back, but our livers go back even further. And it's really great to have Kevin Mitchell on board. Kevin, welcome to Soul by Todd Richards.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. You're in Charleston, South Carolina, which has a storied history. But, you know, give some people some quick background on your food, where you come from, why Charleston, and why do you love to cook?
Oh, well, my food is, well, everyone knows I'm a chef instructor at the Culinary Institute of Charleston here in Charleston, South Carolina. And my journey to Charleston just comes through working in several different aspects of the industry, hotels, university dining. I was a chef at Cornell University for a couple years. I worked Starwood Hotels, which is, of course, now Marriott, and opened up hotels throughout the country for the company. And I worked for MGM, Detroit Hotel and Casino. And my journey to Charleston started in 2008 when I was recruited by the Culinary Institute of Charleston to be its very first African-American chef instructor, of which I'm still the only one after almost 13 years. But the journey here just came from wanting to get into a place where I felt like I could give back. And that meant teaching future chefs. And when the opportunity came, for one, wanting to get out of the snow and the cold of Detroit, Michigan.
Certainly you would get out of from Chicago, and, you know, and where does the land of Chicago goes to Detroit. So I understand that.
Yeah, definitely. So, wanting to have a African American chef instructor, of course, to have someone at the school that looked like the student population. Our student population for African American and even minority students was coming in well over 40%, and they never had a African American chef instructor. And when I came to visit, I fell in love with the city. Of course, fell in love with the history of the city as it relates to food. And like I said, I've been here ever since, you know, December of 2008. And throughout my time here, I've just, you know, kind of elevated and moved into many different aspects of really trying to understand the food of Charleston. For one, becoming a South Carolina chef ambassador. Mostly important to me was, you know, the recreation of the Nat Fuller dinner, which was a dinner held here in 1865, where a formerly enslaved chef who became one of the greatest black caterers in the city hosted a dinner at the end of the Civil War to celebrate equality and, of course, in the spirit of reconciliation. So for the very first time in this city, you know, blacks and whites being able to break bread in the same place was very important. And from that dinner really opened up this kind of chasm for me to really try to understand and research who were these other chefs, whether they were formerly enslaved or even freed chefs and cooks who basically lay the groundwork for, you know, what we know of today as Southern food.
I mean, you bring up so many other questions. Oh my goodness. I mean, we only have about 45 minutes here, but we have so many questions here. So Kevin, you know, you were talking about the area of black and white, and one thing that we found in this country that black and white has always been the divide. No one wants to live in the gray. Our food is not in the gray. When you talk about Southern versus soul, or Southern versus any other American dish, or even soul versus Caribbean or Latin influenced food, what is the similarities you find in these cuisines of America that you really started your research with?
For me, it always starts with the ingredients. We all use the ingredients in many dishes. The one, I guess, difference would be how we use those ingredients. But the major similarity, of course, for me has always been about the people who was cooking the food, whether it was enslaved Africans, African Americans, those from the Caribbean, and so on and so forth. That's where the similarity is. And I think a lot of people look at our food or this food in a very convoluted sense where it has no eloquence, I guess I would say, because, you know, we always think of French cuisine, or we always admire Italian cuisine or some of the other cuisines of the world, and it never really put Southern food, soul food, Gullah Geechee food, whichever you want to call it, on the same pedestal as those very well-known and respected foods.
You know, we're going to talk about Gullah Geechee later on, especially with you in Charleston. But I really want to dive deeper into what you were just saying about the respect of food. And why that's so important to me is that, you know, of course, I'm writing a new book. You wrote a great book that is being released very, very soon. And I'm proud to, you know, to even, you know, read the back page of it. And for those who don't know, the name of the book is Taste the South Carolina Signature Foods, Recipes, and Their Stories. And food itself is just telling a story of people. It's telling a journey of people. You know, what is this commonplace of food that tells this journey that, you know, the ultimate outcome of your book that you want people to reach?
Well, when people read this book, I definitely want them to understand the food. I mean, we focus mainly in on South Carolina, but of course South Carolina is, you know, definitely part of the South. So we want people to really understand where this food comes from. We want people to understand the ingredients, you know, because the book is about dishes as well as ingredients, and get them to understand that what the connection of these ingredients mean to not only people from South Carolina, but people from the South, right? And so people also have to understand, once again, that the connection to those ingredients, to those dishes, come from the connection with the people that cook those foods, whether it's today, whether it's 1800 or whether it's 1600.
Let me ask you a question though, because you're talking about today and 1600s, but are the ingredients that much different? Are the techniques that much different? You know, you and I go way back, and I talk about techniques more than anything else. I can walk into anybody's kitchen and cook because I talk about techniques. Mm-hmm. Are the techniques any different from in your research of this book, where the modern table may not understand it? Because I believe that when you talk about the Carolina gold rice or the pigeon peas or Sea Island red peas and things like that, that I don't think that people, they might think they're foreign, but they don't understand that the technique might also get them there to have delicious food.
Well, yeah, definitely. I think with anything, of course, techniques have always evolved. And, you know, when you talk about technique in your sense, I see and I notice how you take those techniques and evolve from what the original thing would have been. And you mentioned rice. I mean, we know there's numerous ways to cook rice. And, you know, Carolina gold, specifically, one of the things that you mentioned is, you know, it's, I always, you know, tease people, you know, rice can be a very hard thing to cook, even though it's a very simple ingredient to work with. But, you know, as it relates to the Gullah Geechee people, you have to understand the technique of rinsing the rice, you know, and it's not just rinsing the rice three times. It's 6, 7, 8 times, depending on, you know, how much starch is in, you know, in that rice. So I think the techniques change, but they still always remain the same. And if you, and as you know, and we know as chefs, if you understand the technique and also understand the ingredient and where it comes from, there's, you know, there's no way you won't be able to cook, you know, a beautiful pot of Carolina gold rice.
Oh, well, you know, what I find so fascinating about this is just talking about rice. And that, you know, we look at instant rice takes 5 minutes to cook, but Carolina gold rice can take 40 minutes to cook. And the washing of it can be so different. That's why you and I are both fans of Iron Chef, especially Iron Chef, you know, Japanese. And you can see how, and when first Iron Chef Japanese, Machiba, you know, he would have the traditional cast iron pot with the bamboo on top and cook it that way. And you saw the progressions always to Morimoto, where he would have a rice cooker out and things like that. So we understand that there's a progression, but how is it that in our community that in that progression, we might have lost flavor in the sense that something might become instant, may not be the best end result that reminds us of our grandmothers, great grandmothers, our grandparents, or that table at, you know, at the church social and things like that. How do we lose our that part of the culture in the technique? Which I really think that when I read your, you know, your book and everything you saw me, I saw you really telling that story in more depth detail.
Yeah, I think losing those stories, those techniques come through. For one, I believe it's up to people like you and I to continue to educate people on those techniques and on those, you know, old ways of doing things. Because once again, what is new is old, or what is old is new. I think it just becomes a thing of not being educated. And of course, you know, throughout time, we've become a people of convenience. Everything has to happen right away. And you mentioned instant rice, and, you know, anyone of course can go in and, you know, cook some instant rice. Or, I mean, you know, now you can buy, you know, Ben's favorite in a bag and microwave it in a minute and a half. You have rice that you can eat. And I think we've lost the education piece, and through that we've just lost, you know, I won't say respect in a bad way, but we've just lost the respect for how those ingredients were handled years ago. And, you know, we once again, it's just being in this stage of, you know, wanting things right then and there. And, you know, life moves really fast. And, you know, mothers come home and they have, you know, 15 minutes to get some food on the table for their children. And this is what we kind of morph into by using those, you know, the minute rice or the boil and bag rice and, or, you know, the easy microwave.
But you know, I'm not going to be hypocritical that, you know, that in the same token that my mom, you know, in a pinch would make, you know, the box macaroni and cheese and powdered cheese. And I was like, you know, how can I be hypocritical in that same sense where if I eat potato chips, you know, like the sour cream and cheddar potato chips, and that cheese powder is the same cheese powder that, you know, that is used on macaroni and cheese.
Yep.
I mean, when you really think about it that way, so you can go to a baseball game, basketball game, you know, eat a bag of chips and be like, you know, these chips are great, but I can't put it on mac and cheese. Are we not really looking at our cuisine full circle as how, you know, convenience or migration from one side of the country all the way to California, even up there where Eduardo is in Seattle, are we not looking at the techniques of, you know, the Industrial Revolution or things like that as a catalyst to understand how, you know, this food of soul has become a much better food moving forward?
Well, yeah, I definitely think we don't, you know, for me, it's always a thing of looking back, looking to the past, in order to progress and in order to know where we're going. So, you know, I know it's, at times it could be hard to really look to the past because once again, where we are in the world today and all the things that are happening in the world, you know, whether it's a pandemic, whether it's, you know, racial unrest, it's so many different things. And, you know, I think, you know, we get so caught up in those things that it's hard for us to really take the time to look back and, you know, go into a book and say, you know, how was rice cooked in the 1800s and how has it changed from 1800 to 2021? In some respects, yes, because we have instant, but no, because we still have people, specifically you and me and other chefs, who hold on to that tradition and hold on to wanting to bring that forward and still educate and still teach people to say, yeah, it's great that you can throw this pouch in the microwave for a minute and a half, but it's really great when you sit down to a bowl of rice or anything and you've taken the 45 minutes, an hour, whether it's rice, even grits too. Like we take that time, you know, and you get so much satisfaction from, you know, you may not be it may not be satisfying you in the moment where you're like, man, this thing's been on here for an hour. When can I sit down and eat? But when you finally sit down and eat that pot of rice or that bowl of grits or whatever, it's a satisfaction that for me doesn't really compare to popping that stuff in the microwave.
We're about 2 minutes from taking a break here, but there's just one item that I want to talk about in rice. And you said grits and you know, people always ask me why my grits are so good because I take a whisk and sit there and stir them all day, you know, just the same way making risotto. But there is a fallacy in harvest rice that we overlook, which I believe is the best part of rice, is when those grains are broken. Everyone looks for perfection in things like rice. But those broken grains have so much different texture. When we equate that to something like soul food, where you're taking these scraps of things, and we all know the price of oxtails right now is as much as flat iron, where it used to be 99 cents a pound, and now, you know, oxtails are $7.95 a pound. Flat iron steak is $7.95 a pound. And most people don't even know how versatile flat iron steak is in the sense that you can braise it or you can do it as a steak. Why, or let me ask it differently, How can we make sure that we are telling the true story of things that are broken that we fix in order to make soul, Caribbean, Afro, a true American cuisine, just as we're talking about jazz, rock and roll, and hip hop?
Well, definitely it starts with things like this podcast, and it starts with education. It starts with, you know, just people like you and I and other chefs really talking about what is important to the tradition of our food, and definitely what's important to holding on to those traditions and getting people to want to, of course, follow those traditions, right? Because of course, time changes and things change, and you got technology and you got all these things happening. And once again, it's convenient, it's fast, and we have to hold true and teach, you know, the chefs that are coming, well, the chefs and the cooks that are coming behind us, to say, yes, once again, this is great that we can have rice in 2 minutes or grits in five, but let's focus in on what really makes our food what our food is. And it's up to us to continue to push the envelope, to continue to, you know, beat down the doors, so to speak, and talk about it so that our cuisine will be or can be put up on that pedestal and respected like French cuisine, like Italian cuisine, where we know, you know, chefs, we know where a lot of that food comes from. And it comes from the same traditions that we have used, but it, for some reason, it just seems like it's put in this light where it's very exclusive and it's very high profile, and, you know, making rice is something that is not. But we know that even specifically here in Charleston, Charleston doesn't become Charleston without the cultivation of rice. And even French planters who lived in this area, who may have eaten classical French cuisine every night cooked by formerly enslaved people or enslaved people, that there was always a pot of rice on the table with them, right? So how can our food not be elevated to where it should be based on our history, based on the facts, based on what chefs are doing or were doing then and what chefs are doing now?
I really understand that so much. We have to take a pause here. I mean, I don't want to, but we have to take a pause here because I really want to talk about what you're saying about just in rice in general and in your book as well, and really explore deeper into the technique of food and talk about culinary instructors, because I really believe in the next segment, we have to dive deeper into that, because I believe that there's been such a backlash against culinary instructors that if you don't have someone instructing someone how to cook food, who's going to cook the food? Mm-hmm. So you're listening to Soul by Chef Todd Richards.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back to Soul by Chef Todd Richards. I'm glad to have one of my dearest and closest friends, a great culinarian, and really one of the most outstanding cooks that I know, Chef Kevin Mitchell out of Charleston, South Carolina, and probably more nationally and even internationally known in the world right now than just saying Charleston. And I don't want to diminish Charleston, but Kevin has just released a book called Tastes the State, South Carolina Signature Food Recipes and Their Stories. And really, you know, our first segment, we're talking about the stories and the stories tying into, you know, basic of the techniques. But what makes food signature? You know, we talk about rice, grits, things like that. But what makes food signature to a group of people first is my first question. And maybe my second question is how do we share it amongst people in order to find that appreciation of that signature dish?
Well, I think flavor, for one, makes something signature. When we look at kind of the evolution of rice, we always go back to rice or corn as it relates to grits. You know, the flavor of rice in the 1800s, you know, could be transported to what we know today as rice, right? We know we have Ben's Favorite, we have all these other brands of rice, but true, we have to go back to the source, and that is, of course, the Carolina Gold. You know, the strands of rice that come to us from Africa. Also, you know, when we speak of Asia as well, but in Southern food, we're always, of course, looking at those strands or strains that come from Africa. So I think, you know, the flavor and always keeping or holding true to what the original flavor of that particular ingredient was.
Let me ask you a question right quick and pause. Okay, but you said something about the original flavor was something was. And I have to ask a more clearer question is how do you know in the depth of your soul what the original flavor was?
Well, you have to get it from that ingredient, rice, if we want to specifically talk about rice, we have to get it from someone that is producing and cultivating that original strand, you know, that original seed that was brought over with enslaved people to this country, right? And we have to, of course, have or build that relationship with these producers, cultivators, purveyors who are, you know, really involved in really telling the story of true Carolina Gold rice or true Sea Island red peas. And it's the sharing of those stories and tasting and understanding what the flavors are. I mean, of course, you know, we won't always know what rice tasted like in 1800, but we do know what rice was produced in 1800. And we do know the story of what the rice was and how we lost it, you know, specifically here through the Civil War. The Civil War destroyed all the rice plantations specifically in Charleston or in the South. And then, of course, we have the onset of Uncle Ben's or Ben's Favorites that comes a lot later after the Civil War. So I think it's always about research, understanding the flavor profile, you know, always working with those producers who are, you know, a part of this revival of bringing back these old grains, whether it's rice, whether it's specific types of corn to make grits, or you mentioned Sea Island red peas, black-eyed peas, field peas, crowder peas, all these things that, you know, seem to have disappeared. But I think the great thing is they're coming back, like through companies like Anson Mills and Marsh Hen Mills here in South Carolina as well, where, you know, and then of course we have to encourage chefs to want to serve these products in on their menus in their restaurants.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I don't want to stray too far away from the original question, but this question is probably going to tie that question up. And you said something about chefs doing it. And the reach is that, you know, the chefs are the experts, but the consumers are the ones who have to understand it. Where have we lost our way in some of this? And the reason why I'm asking this is not to have us sit here and say, you know, that you know, we didn't do things right. Yeah. It's more of a pathway of saying what we're going to do in the future in order to make, you know, this food stand out more. How we're going to unite Afro cuisine throughout the world. Only in this country do we talk about ourselves in minority aspects, anywhere, everywhere else, so, you know, we're a majority. But not in the sense of negativity where we're saying we're better, just saying that we are equal to and we produce great food. Mm-hmm. In spite of our lack of diversity at the table, what is the true sense of, you know, kind of where we lost it, but how are we going to move it forward in order to serve more delicious food at the table?
Well, as an educator, I always start off by saying it's education. As chefs, you know, even though I am a chef instructor by title, because I formerly teach people in school, but chefs in restaurants are educators as well, right? So they have to have these items on their menu to educate their customers. And so their customers are like, well, wow, I had this really great succotash that contained these peas that were grown 100 years ago, and now this chef is bringing them back. And also, we have to get more involved in producing these items as well. Like, you know, we have to, even as Black farmers or just Black chefs in general, where we have to have a conscious decision to say, we're going to educate, we're going to purchase, we're going to support not only Black farmers, but Black producers as well, to educate our customers, to encourage our customers to seek out these ingredients. So it's not a thing of, well, only certain people can get Anson Mills rice. Well, we know that's not true. You can go to the website and have a 5-pound bag delivered directly to your home.
Let me ask you a question, though. I mean, in this, and especially in this political format that we're in, though, how do we defend ourselves of being against segregationists? You know, that we are saying that, you know, that Black farmers, Black this, Black that, that, you know, historically, we've always produced this food from everyone, mm-hmm. or for everyone. But in the same token, that it's not understood in our community, nor can our community necessarily afford a rice or a grit or this, you know, high caliber thing that we might only be relegated to things that are simple, quick, fast, and hurry because we have to work, you know, exponentially more hours than anyone else. How do we do it as a community of chefs, either instructor or restaurateurs, in order to bring that back? And I do believe your book is a catalyst for it, but I want to hear your take on that.
Well, you mentioned one key word, I mean, community. We, as a community, we have to get together. And as you said earlier, it's not looking at he's Caribbean, he's this, she's that. We are all one. Right. And we have to come together as a community. And as far as like defending ourselves, for me, I don't necessarily, it could be defending myself, but I don't look at it like that. I look at it as, hey, I'm a chef. I'm here. I'm educating you. You could take the knowledge any way that you want, mm-hmm. but we still have to have the conviction to want to continue to pursue, work with our community, bring these ingredients back, serve these ingredients. And then, of course, you mentioned a key thing as far as the availability or even the being able to afford, right? Because you mentioned now, you know, you can't buy oxtails, you know, for less than, I mean, even some places, $10 a pound for something that was, you know, you can go to the store and get a 10-pound bag and pay $2 for, or even the same thing with rice.
Right.
Rice, you know, Carolina Gold, and we know it's not cheap. So we have to, and you're right, we have to figure out.
Gold is in the name, you know. Yeah. So, right.
But we have to find a way to bring it to a level playing field where, as you say, anybody can purchase Carolina Gold and not feel like, you know, they're spending, they're taking away from paying the bills to take care of their families because they want this rice, right? And you go to the store, we all go to the store, and I mean, even me sometimes when I look at the price, I'm like, I don't want to pay that. Like, right. I know that I could have gotten this 100 years ago for $1 a pound, you know, as opposed to 10, or even with Carolina Gold, or even, you know, grits, and, you know, and it's once again, just going back to us coming together as a community and demanding, you know, these products and demanding that they are affordable and they are produced in a manner that doesn't hurt people or take advantage of people. Those are things that we need to do. And as chefs and as what we're doing right now, having this conversation, you know, hopefully people that will listen to this will, you know, take this as a catalyst to join in and say, hey, we got to figure this out and let's get together and not be so separated as a community. A community is not separated. A community is together. And I think sometimes, and we've had this conversation before, that sometimes we get so we segregate ourselves, and that that is something that is very counter. It's not counterproductive. You can't say, hey, let's get together, but then it's like, well, no, I'm not gonna deal with this person, right? It just makes no sense. Like, we gotta come together and we have to shake down the egos and really be committed and say, hey, you know, we want all of
our- shake down the egos, but we're the ego driven business.
I know. And it's very hard. It's very hard. You know, it's very hard to do that. I mean, you know, I can, you know, attest for that. I mean, we all have egos and we all, you know, want our food to be the greatest food. And, you know, we have these competitions within ourselves to, you know, well, my dish has got to be better than her dish and his dish. And you're right. And that is probably going to be the hardest thing, is to kind of get rid of the ego part of it. And I think once we can maybe keep our egos in check, maybe it'll never happen that all our egos will go away. But if we can keep them in check and really look at what the bigger picture is, it's like, this is not about me or you. This is about our community. This is about getting these ingredients in the hands of people that, for one, who couldn't afford them, who now can afford them through our working together as a community.
Community, commonplace, common table, those things are inherently talked about or even taught about in our culture. And then the other side of it is separation, being your own person, being your own chef, and things like that. And really, those delicious dishes, one that that you talk about, we talk about rice grits, even okra, you know, where okra, you know, has this bad output until you look at commercial restaurants where they're doing fried okra and things like that. But you say if it's in gumbo, it's this way, but it all comes from the same area. You know, in your book, and we only got about maybe 5-6 more minutes here, Taste the State, South Carolina, Signature Foods, Recipes, and Their Stories. Where was that commonplace? I mean, you talk about black and white at an important time. And I really want to talk about that briefly so that we can actually give the listeners a pathway moving forward. Where was the common table? Because I don't think the common table was just about a pig and someone getting ribs, someone getting pork chops. It was the responsibility of people cooking delicious food that made that table common.
No, I agree. I mean, it always boils down to making sure that the food is delicious, no matter what it is. And for me, no matter who cooks it, right? We keep talking about community. And unfortunately, when we look at black and white, of course, you know, there's some segregation there. But we also know that, you know, we all cook this food. Like we all come, if you live in the South or you were born and bred in the South, you cook this food, whether it was, you know, someone that is white that's frying okra as opposed to someone that's black that's making okra soup, right? Mm-hmm. We still use okra. And you mentioned, you know, the affinity for okra, and we write it in the book that, you know, the affinity for okra comes from people from the South, mainly because of, you know, it coming from Africa and being here and growing here in the South. And the affinity to not eat okra is definitely more in the North, because okra doesn't really make it to the North as much. It makes it there. My grandmother, I grew up in New Jersey. She grew up in North Carolina. She made sure that I had experience with okra, but it's not that prevalent in the North, and people don't have an affinity for it because they think it's slimy. But once again, that's part of the mystique of okra, and you know, there's ways of combating the sliminess of the okra, but you need it. You mentioned gumbo. You need that. You need that viscous texture, right, to make
as
gumbo.
Emulsifier.
Yeah, you need it. So, you know, I just think that you're right. We do have to come to an understanding that this food is just as, you know, elegant and technique driven and delicious as the other types of food that we hold near and dear to our hearts. You know, being a chef instructor, you know, we focus on French culinary techniques because that's the way it's always been. But, you know, I think it's time for, you know, culinary schools, not only in the South, but culinary schools across the country, to really start to embrace Southern food, soul food, and bring it to a level where it deserves to be.
And with ingredients such as okra, mm-hmm. When you think about it from the versatility of it, that you can put it in gumbo as a thickener. You can fry it crispy. You can grill it, most certainly, you know, being grilled. You can, remove the outer green and make, pudding or something like that, with like tapioca, you know, with those things. I remember Corey Lee in his Banu cookbook, he had a dish, I think it was a crab dish, where he finished it with sliced thin okra on top as a crispy texture, mm-hmm. Really to bring those things together. But why do we have such polarization in it when it comes from soul and moving forward? And just understanding that when we think about something about red beans and rice is a, you know, Haitian dish that went to Louisiana and came up north, that, you know, okra is an ingredient that we might shun, but when you think about commercial restaurants, the Applebee's of the world and places like that that have fried okra on the table, where do we lose our soul or our identity in dishes like some?
I think it's mainly for me, it's all about the kind of the stigma, like the stigma of okra, and it's slimy, and people don't understand, as you say, the versatility. You know, you can, you know, dry it and grind it into a flour and use it in baking and or breading. I mean, it's so many people just don't understand the versatility of it. And I think, you know, food gets, or specific ingredients, they come with this specific stigma where it's not seen as something that is, for one, delicious, two, that's very versatile, and that is a part of who we are as people. I mean, you could say the same thing for fried chicken.
Absolutely.
Been to a, you know, and people laugh about, you know, going to work and not wanting to eat, you know, specifically black people not wanting to eat fried chicken in front of white people. Well, white people eat fried chicken too. I mean, I think that's right, right? Well, everybody eats fried chicken, and we know that no matter where you go, there's something fried, some type of fried animal. So whether it's chicken, rabbit, or
anything else, you know, Lewis and Clark expedition, you know, showed us that their versatility from frying rabbits to chicken all the way across the board.
So, and I don't understand where people are like, oh, you know, I'm not going to, you know, fried chicken. Well, okay, yeah, everybody eats fried chicken. They don't want to admit that they eat it. And, you know, you can also say the same thing for watermelon, for certain people, specifically here in the South. You know, the stigma of, you know, what watermelon was specifically during
Juneteenth, right? I mean, watermelon starts growing at that part of Juneteenth. I mean, if you're ashamed to, you know, see that during Juneteenth, then it's like, well, I mean, that's when the real true watermelon season starts.
Yep.
We only have about one more minute here, and I really appreciate that. We're on Soul by Todd Richards, Chef Todd Richards, with Kevin Mitchell, one of my closest and longest friends. And he wrote a terrific book. I mean, if you don't pick this book up, shame on you. Taste the State, South Carolina's Signature Foods, Recipes, and Their Stories. But Kevin, this last minute here, really, you know, how do we make our food not more relevant, because I believe that relevancy is a fleeting way of thinking. How do you make it permanent and delicious? What is your, you know, what is something in the book that people say, I gotta cook this year over year, whether it's Easter Sunday, Thanksgiving, Christmas or holiday season? What is that one dish that people need to taste in order to make sure that they have the experience of your book?
Well, we write an extensive kind of chapter on purlieus, right? One beautiful one pot rice dishes that can include meat and or vegetables. I think, you know, that particular dish, specifically here in this area, is a very important dish to kind of keep in your repertoire, so to speak, because it speaks to so many things that are very traditional and true to our culture, right? We know rice makes the South what it is, specifically Charleston. We know that slaves were only given one pot, right? And they had to make a meal that was sustainable for a family. Mm. And how best do you do that? By making a one pot rice dish, a purlieu. You know, we can also mention in Louisiana, you know, we have jambalaya, right? And it's a dish that transcends throughout all cultures, right? We have purlieu, pilau, pilaf, jambalaya, right. You know, paella, right? All these beautiful one pot rice dishes that for me encompasses the culture of enslaved African Americans, you know, and also, you know, to go beyond that, it's looking at, of course, Hop and John, which we all know we eat during the new year, or the coming new year. Right, a very beautiful dish, and it has a really great story. So, you know, to connect yourself to, if you want to connect yourself to South Carolina, I guess through this book, always look at these purlieus, Hop and John, red rice, you know, all these beautiful things that stem from this one pot, and to understand, you know, what our people went through during that time in history.
I oh my goodness, we could probably be here all day. Like, I'm talking about rice. Everybody knows we have an affinity, love for rice. You know, whether it's in, you know, savory form, mash form. I love croquettes made out of rice. I like sweet rice, sushi, which is something that we don't have time to even discuss here. You know, pickled fish and rice, which is not just exclusively for sushi, it's for a lot of other cultures. But Kevin, please tell everyone where they can find you on social media.
You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Chef Scholar. And also for email, chefscholar@gmail.com.
And where can they find your book, most importantly, because I believe that all the recipes in there, people are going to want to know how to cook it, hopefully after this episode.
Yes. They can go to the uscpress.com, and then they can put Taste the State in the search engine. It is available for pre-sale. It will be released in bookstores on October the 12th.
I want to make sure everyone understands USC, because we are in the South, is University of South Carolina, yep. Not USC, University of Southern California. Yep. You know, they both play college football, but one is a different type of cuisine, another one is delicious. We'll just leave it at that. Thank you so much, my great friend, Kevin Mitchell, Chef Kevin Mitchell, an instructor, all-around great guy, for being on this season two, first episode of Soul by Todd Richards. And you are listening to Soul by Todd Richards.
Soul by Todd Richards is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of Food World's most innovative community? Subscribe to shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.